Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Let me just kind of frame up what we're going to cover today. One of the things that is challenging in working with young people, teenagers, is that not only does teenage culture change, but the actual culture of an individual person, the way an individual person responds differently at different points in their development. For instance, if you would have known me when I was, say you were my youth leader, when I was 11 or 12 years old, and you were working with me during the summer, here's what my life looked like in the summer. I got up in the morning and put on my cut-off jean shorts and a white t-shirt. And that's all I put on. I never put on shoes in the summer because there's no reason to wear shoes in the summer. And that's just, you know, a bother. And I would go all week never putting on shoes. And at the end of the day, I'd go to bed and I'd take off my jean shorts and my white t-shirt and go to bed. And then actually I'd sometimes leave that same white t-shirt on. The next morning I'd put the same one on. I could wear the same clothes for 5 days in a row and never even notice. The only time I put on shoes was on Sunday to go to church. I would get up in the morning and I would never look in the mirror. My hair was whatever it looked like when I got out of bed. That's what I was like. And all of a sudden came this moment when I was 13 years old that I went to my first junior high youth camp. And here was my biggest question as I was going on that camp. What am I going to wear there? What am I going to wear there? And I had these long discussions with my sister, who was a little older than me, who had been to this camp, and, you know, like, what's the right thing to wear? And she helped me plan out my whole wardrobe for this junior high camp. And, you know, which clothes I was, in fact, I was so careful about what I was going to wear that I changed clothes, and I wore one thing in the morning and one thing in the evening. This is only 1 year later. And I can remember thinking, okay, does this shirt look right? Are these pants right? And halfway through the day, I changed. And at one spot, I don't know why it happened, someone came up and looked at my shirt, and it was tucked in, and he pulled it out and said, "Why is your shirt tucked in?" And I was devastated. Devastated. I don't remember anything that the speaker said. I don't remember anything else that happened, but I know that I should have had my shirt tucked in, and my shirt was tucked out. My shirt should have been tucked out, and it was tucked in, and I was just crushed. Now, why when I was 12 years old did I not care anything about it? When I was 13 years old, that's all I cared about, and that was only 1 year later. What's going on? Now, there's some things that as you work with young people, you go, why do they act this way? Like, why does that happen? Or you watch your young people and you go, why is that? Any things that go through your mind like that? Like here's another one. When I was in junior high, I was probably a younger teenager, we had this whole system of points and awards and different things where, and I would do anything to get points and awards, especially if it had to do with candy. All right, just like highly competitive. And I remember I got to high school and somebody tried to do the same thing. All right, guys, we're going to come up with points and we're going to see which team wins and they get candy. And we're all sitting there going, they're treating us like kids. You ever know, some of you, if you know Awana program, which works really well with younger people, why did it just stop working? And everyone's going, man, that doesn't motivate me at all. You know, why is that? Okay, some other things. Or maybe another one, why when you find somebody who has really vibrant faith in high school then just loses it in college? You know, you could say, but sometimes you've seen it and it's just gone. Well, we're going to try to come up with some answers to that and also help you to be able to look at a group of young people and know how to modify what you're doing to fit their stage of development. And actually, this will be fabulous when, how many of you had kids? Okay, great. This is actually really important when it comes to talking about, someone came to me during the break yesterday and said, my son, I sit down and we're reading the Bible, but he won't listen. And I said, you know, what are you reading? Well, we're reading through the letters of Paul. Okay, well, I wonder how, and I said, how old's your son? He said, he's 3.
Rejoice in the Lord. So were you talking about the importance of the glory of God, that God is most pleased in us when we are most satisfied in Him, or something like that? Okay. So it could be actually a developmental issue. Within the mind of young people, two things change as they grow. Content, what they know, and structure, how they organize what they know. So two things change. Content is added gradually over time. So content looks like this. People just grow and they learn and they're establishing various skills, but structure changes in steps. And this is why you can hit a spot where within 6 months, actually, the entire way a young person thinks can change. They go along at a certain stage and the stage changes, and there are abrupt changes in the entire way that a young person thinks. I wish I would have remembered, because I often, when I have this talk, I bring my journals, because I told you can actually see my handwriting change in a period of about 3 months when I hit one of these stages. If you look back on your life, you'll see, wow, why was I saying that? Why was I thinking like that? And sometimes it'll change within just three to six months. These changes affect several different areas. They affect logic. So I think in a certain way, what's logical to me is a certain, and then all of a sudden my whole logic, the way my mind is working logically, how we think and understand is different. This is a Calvin and Hobbes, and there he is right there. He says, oh no, everything has suddenly turned neo-cubist. You could see that everything's kind of got these lines. It all started when Calvin engaged his dad in a minor debate. Soon Calvin could see both sides of the issue. He could see both sides of the issue. Then poor Calvin began to see both sides of everything. The traditional single viewpoint has been abandoned. Perspective has been fractured. These multiple views provide too much information. It's impossible to move. Calvin quickly tries to eliminate all but one perspective. It works. The world falls into a recognizable order. You're still wrong, Dad. So at a stage of life like that, someone can only see one perspective. And seeing two views and holding two views at once actually turns their world into chaos. So that's an example of it changes the logic. It also changes the moral reasoning, how we decide what's right and wrong. And a person named Kohlberg, the theorist in this area of logic, is Piaget. He talked about how the mind worked. The major theorist in the area of moral reasoning was a man named Kohlberg. And he would ask, let's say a child, he would say, is it wrong to take this piece of candy? Or is it wrong to walk through a red light or something like that? He'd ask him if it's wrong or right. And then he'd ask him the second question, why? Why? And what he was looking for was, what was the reason for them to come to that conclusion? So we saw that video about people saying, the interview in Washington, is it okay if I tell you that I'm a woman or not? You remember that? It'd be really interesting to ask the question why later, because you might actually get the same answers but a different why. So sometimes people come to the same moral conclusion, but they come to a different why. And in those various stages, they will have a different reason for their moral conclusions, and we'll get to some of the different ones why. Relationships, how we build and maintain relationships. Why is someone my friend, and how do they remain my friend? It changes in these stages. And the last one is source of authority, who we listen to or why. Why are some friends? Why do I listen to some friends? Why not? Why, if someone comes and says, I have a doctorate, if I come to a youth group of high schoolers and say, I have a doctorate in relationships, let me tell you about how you should be dating. What do you think they're going to say? They'll probably say, because you have a doctorate, you're less qualified, right? But if I would come to this group here and say, I have a doctorate in relationships, let me tell you about dating, they would all go, doctorate in relationships? We're listening. You know, why did a doctorate mean nothing to me? And it wasn't just about education, it's about a developmental stage when I was 17, and it means something to me later on. Source of authority, who we listen to and why. According to Fowler, Piaget, Kohlberg, and others, and these are some of the theorists, there's actually lots and lots of research behind this. Piaget did the cognitive development, Fowler did the spiritual development, Kohlberg, the moral development. But there's five basic stages. Each is characterized by a different stream in which the person is embedded. And so here's the key. If I'm sitting on this raft and I'm going down the stream, then from my perspective, everything on this raft is stable, and the sides of the bank are going by. So I'm actually embedded. So from my standpoint, the stream's not moving. The bank is moving because I'm in the stream. So whatever stream you're in, you see the world through that lens and from that stream. And you don't even know it's a stable place for you, and everything else is moving around it. Okay? So there's a stream that you're embedded in. That's the place that you see the world out through. And here's the first stage. In stage one, between 2 and 7 years, they're embedded in the stream of intuition. In other words, they see the world out with intuition. They don't even know that it's intuitive because that basically is the world. That's the way the world works. And but that's how they come to understanding about meaning. That's how they think. So when our kids were young, sometimes they'd say, you know, when are we going to have dinner? And I'd say, half an hour. What's a half an hour? To how old are your kids? To a three-year-old, yeah. To especially in the earlier stage. Now some of this is sometimes it doesn't always go that high, and so I'd have to say, well, it's a poo movie, and I can intuitively feel how long a poo movie is, and then I know. But like an abstract concept like time is much harder. I can remember one time that my son said, "Dad, you're going on a trip." And I said, yeah. He said, you're going alone. I said, yeah. Won't you be lonely? No, I'll be fine. Really, aren't you going to be lonely? Because he can only intuitively feel that if he was on the trip, he would be lonely. So I must be lonely too. So I get ready to go out the door, and he says, Dad, here. He can go with you. And I said, what? And he hands me poo, you know, his bear. And he says, because I don't want you to be lonely. So what's he thinking? He's intuitively feeling, I'd be lonely, you know. Pooh helps me not be lonely. He must help you not be lonely. And he can't think. This is not a logical thing. This is just intuition. They intuit about their world. Sometimes Tyler, who's my oldest son, he'd say something really that I think was quite brilliant and smart. And I'd say, Tyler, how did you know that? And he'd go, I just knowed. Just know. He can't tell me where I saw this and reasoned this and then I came to this conclusion. They just know. They just feel. They just sense. They feel the whole world through intuition. And that's why you can say, honey, I love you. And they'll start to cry because they'll intuitively be reading the world. The context is very, very important for them. And they don't go and kind of, they just absorb it. They just take it in as it comes at them. Now, because of that, they learn language. They just absorb language. How do they learn language? They just go, you know, they just intuit it. It just sounds right. They don't learn how to parse the verbs or something like that. But it also means that the environment that they're in is very important. The overall environment of the family is actually sometimes more important than the. It's like the spirit that's going on around them is as important as the content itself. Because of that, they love stories, and they'll want to hear a story over and over and over again because they're experiencing the story, they're feeling the story, and they learn in very, very intuitive ways. So I remember one time I was putting my kids to bed at night, and my son Caleb, he said, Daddy, how big is Jesus? How big is Jesus? I don't know how big Jesus is. And I'm trying to figure out what. And he said, is he bigger than you? And then all of a sudden I realized, okay, big is associated with power and authority. So I said, well, yeah, I think he's probably bigger than me. Is he bigger than my bunk bed? Yeah, he probably is. Is he bigger than this room? Yeah, he is. Oh. I said, Caleb, why are you asking? And he said, well, if he's that big, I don't need to be afraid. So you see that intuitive, they're very much just taking all the world in through intuition. And so you're going to have a hard time with things like concepts like grace and love and various ones like that. So they will read the tone of voice and not even often listen to the word. So so logic, they actually don't have much logic. This is actually, well... I'm going to go through. I'll tell you the streams, and then we'll go back into them. Okay. The second one is events, so we'll come back into this. events is 7 to 15 years of old. And some of these are, it could go earlier, it could go later. The time that they move into stage is not exact, but these stages are invariant. In other words, people don't skip these stages and everyone goes through them. So in this stage right here of events, you organize your life around, your reasoning becomes very concrete, and you organize your life around around actual things. So if you ask someone in this stage, tell them, how was the movie? They'll say they're great. And they'll say, tell you about it. And they can tell you the entire movie. They just, it's the events that go on. If you look at my journals, I have journals back from when I was about 12 years old. And this is how my journals always start. I got up at 7 o'clock. I had eggs for breakfast. Then I went to school. School started at 8:15. It was a good day. I didn't have much homework. Did you just hear these things? I'll often say it was good, it was bad, I was bored, this happened. But if you read my journal, it's really all about the events that are happening. I'm not thinking about the meaning of life. I'm not philosophizing about anything. I'm experiencing life as it's coming at me in various events. Now, I actually did my master's thesis on this particular question of development and interviewed a lot of young people. And I interviewed some people on this stage and I said, tell me about your best friend. And they said, my best friend is Tim. Well, why are you guys such good friends? Well, he likes basketball and I like basketball too. What's another friend? Mike. Oh, why are you good friends with Mike? Well, we walk home from school together. You hear this? You know? And it's not, we sit and have conversation. And all of their friendships will be rooted in some activity that they do together. It won't be that their friendships are really revolve around events, around the doing, which is why Awana works so well for this age, because there's so much activity, there's doing, things are concrete. Now, I can remember when I was 12 years old, my dad gave me a Living Bible, a good translation, and he challenged me to read through it. And I read through the whole Bible when I was 12 years old. And at the beginning is so cool. God creates the world, you know. And then there's this tower that falls, and, you know, there's this big flood and all this. And then I get to this book called Ecclesiastes. And I just had a horrible time in Ecclesiastes. Just terrible. Because I'm reading along and it says meaningless, everything is meaningless. And I remember going to my dad and saying, how did this book get in the Bible? It says everything's meaningless. So I'm taking everything at face value. My logic is very concrete. It's not abstract. And so what it says, it is. And I got some of the prophets. I had a hard time. I got into the epistles and they were so boring. And I remember coming to my dad and I said, I just read this book called Philippians and it was so, so boring. And dad saying, you know, someday that might be one of your favorite books. I couldn't imagine that that would be true. Because it's all about concepts, right? It's all about ideas. And unless it's rooted in concrete reality, then I have a hard time handling it. So if you were teaching, let's start thinking about this particular as we're getting into it. So let's say you have a group of, they're 12, 13 years. How would this impact your teaching? And actually, let me see if I can move ahead, because here we go. So we've got, in 2 to 7 years old, logic is fantasy, story, intuition, imagination. Moral reasoning, by the way, is punishment and reward. So why is something wrong? Because I'm going to get punished. Why is something right? Because I intuitively feel. And this is some of the things, if you have young kids, I'll often see people, as like in the store, and be down with their kids, and they'll say, honey, don't do that, because it's really hard on mommy when you do that, because it makes a lot of extra work for mommy. That just won't, what are you doing? You're trying to logically show, and you're actually trying to have that kid see the perspective through mom's eyes, and she's just not going to. So it's really poor discipline. It's like just babbling. Basically, you have to do something that they intuitively feel. If this happens, you'll get a spanking, and that will hurt. If you do this, this will happen. It has to be something, you'll have to go sit in the corner. It has to be something that actually they experience intuitively as being right or wrong. The relationships They're examples, action stories of the primarily related adults, and their source of authority is attachment and dependence, and also size. If you're bigger, you have more authority. Okay. If he's big, or if I'm attached to you, that's my uncle, that's my that's my dad, and because I intuitively feel, oh, I belong to you, you must have authority over me. But here's in the stage two, concrete cause and effect relationships. Moral reasoning is reciprocity. So you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It's kind of, what do I get from it? Like, and so sometimes they'll go, it's wrong to go through a red light. Why? Well, because a cop will take you and give you a fine or something like that. It's really about these cause and effects kinds of things. Relationships are molded by events, what I do with people, and sources of authority are positions, titles, or achievements. Okay, now think about this. You're working with, say, a Doros group or something, a younger group. How would this impact how you'd work with them? Just look through there. Any thoughts? If you want to get close to them, how do you get close to them? You want to build relationships with them. How do you do that? You're going to have to do something together. In fact, if you just say, hey, let's just sit around and talk, it's like you're giving a lot of information that has no file folder if there's no activity. They're very, very activity-oriented. I remember a youth leader that was working with this age, he had something he called Buff and Bible, and they would go, the guys would go and lift weights together and then read the Bible. But the lifting weights together actually gave them a file folder for the Bible. If they hadn't done anything together, they wouldn't be close. So if you want to build relationships, so when my sons were at this age, because I wanted to build relationships, I had to do things with them. So I said to my son, what do you want to do today? He says, I want to climb a mountain. Okay, let's do that. We climb a mountain, we come back down. Man, Dad, I feel so close to you because of this activity we did together. All right, if you want to, if you want to teach, what would be some places that you could teach or things you could teach about? How would you teach at this stage? What are books of the Bible that would work well?
Stories,
all right. And stories will also work well in stage one, but they'll work well for a different reason in stage two. So what about the stories? What would they be learning from the story? They'd kind of be learning how the world works, okay? So you could see that David trusted God, or this happens, or something like this. Now, there are some other than stories, there are some books of the Bible that would be really good here. But what would be some books, even some teaching books? Which of the epistles would be good at stage two? Any thoughts? Timothy might, but Timothy is still quite conceptual. James is really good. Do this, do this, don't do that. If this happens, this. I've often taught through the book of James with this group because it's just so clear and concrete. It's very action-oriented. All right? Positions, titles, achievements. If you are the youth leader, that's a big deal, okay? You're going to... And external kinds of things. Concrete examples of various. Whenever you can use anything concrete, that really works. Really works well. Now, one of the things that was interesting that when I did this study was I interviewed a bunch of junior hires, people in this age, and I said, when did you have a hard time walking with God? And they would talk about these times. And I found out that one of the characteristics was they had a very hard time with trials. I've been trying to follow God, and I got a trial. If you scratch my back, and I scratch yours. That's not right, right? If I am doing things for you, you should be doing things for me. Or else they could say, I'm going through a trial. I wonder what's wrong with me that I went through a trial. And so they have a hard time, their concrete reasoning, cause and effect, is going to be looking for a direct cause and effect connection. And they're going to say, the cause is either I'm bad or God's bad, right? Because there should be, if God's good and I'm good, then everything should be good. And they have a very hard time with trials. So we had a lot of kids at this age, you have to help them work through that piece. Okay, let's talk a little bit about stage three. Stage three is what you know a lot about. All of a sudden, the gap between stage two and stage three, something changes in your mind, and for the first time, you have the ability to do abstract reasoning. Your brain changes. And there's some things that happen with abstract reasoning. One of them is that you have, for the first time, the ability to think outside yourself. And they sometimes call it, I see you seeing me. So I can look at Honza and think, project, what he might be thinking and seeing in me. Before that, they can't even do that. So in stage two, they don't have the mental wiring to I see you seeing me. And they also don't have the mental wiring to think hypothetically. So if you ask a stage two person, you know, what would happen if you had different parents and lived in China? I don't know. I don't have different parents. I don't live in China. You know, they can't think just this hypothetically about that. And those two additions to their ability to think really change things. One of the things is they now all of a sudden think everyone is thinking about and looking at them. Because for the first time they can perceive other people seeing them. I see you seeing me. So now all of a sudden everyone's seeing me all the time, and they're just overloaded with that information. And so just right when they go into this break, that's why I went to that retreat, and the whole time all I can think about is everybody is looking at my clothes at every minute of all the time. And they become hypersensitive to people's opinions about them, hypersensitive, particularly to those of their peers. And that's one of the reasons why the early stages of this, they're brutal to each other. And partially out of self-protection, but partially out of this, hey, that was stupid, you're dumb, this kind of thing, is kind of this protection of all of a sudden, for the first time, I see you seeing me, and they are now on stage. They become very egocentric. The world revolves around them. And then they also start to think hypothetically. Their parents do something, and they think, wow, if I was my dad, I would do that differently. You see that? I'm hypothetically thinking. Or if I was in Terry's family, I would get better treatment. And there's this hypothetical treatment, that hypothetical ability to think, that's not well developed, and they become quite critical of their families. This is just very, very common. And think that their parents are doing everything wrong. Because they now have the ability to picture their parents doing something different. And they think that different thing would be better. So it's very, and this happens in within about 6 months to a year that they get this new ability, abstract hypothesis, and they also can start thinking about what's going on below the surface. Daniel smiled at me, but I think he maybe is frustrated inside, or either one of these Daniels. And so they're just always analyzing what's really going on, what do you really think, and hypersensitive. Moral reasoning is what's proper in my group. What do people who are important to me expect of me? So this is, Andre, you said, why do they do some groups? It really is about my group. Because now all of a sudden, my reference of authority is this group right here. And it's not what, I don't care if you have a doctorate. I don't care even if it's, are you my friend or not? The person who has the most moral authority is the person who's my friend. There was an interesting study done in the United States where a group of people were trying to prevent drunk driving. And so they put together this fabulous presentation to take to high schools. And they went to these high schools and showed pictures of cars that were wrecked by drunk drivers, statistics about how many people were killed by drunk drivers, all the evidence that driving drunk is really bad for you. And then they came back 6 months later, a year later, and said, are young people doing less driving when they're drunk? And they found out it was exactly the same. They didn't change their behavior. And then they asked the young people, weren't you motivated by all these pictures and these statistics and this data? And they said, no. And they said, why? Well, my friends drink and drive, and none of them has been in an accident. See, the world, my data, this you know, my world is now this group right here, and the rest of the world just kind of fades away. It just kind of disappears. That doesn't matter. So data, you know, data is nothing. Authority, you know, say you got a doctorate over there, but what do you guys think? You're my buds. You're my friends. And so their moral authority becomes very much their group. What's proper to me? What do people who are important to me expect me? So this is both an opportunity for youth ministry, because we can really, if this is my group, if you become my group, I'm going to be watching you a lot and actually making a lot of deciding on my moral decisions based on this group. But it also is dangerous because if that's only what it is, then the same thing happens. I lose this group and I lose my faith. So sometimes people in this age will actually just be socialized into faith because they're in this particular group. What's proper in this group? What do people importantly expect me? So in stage two, if I'm doing an event for stage two, you know what everyone's going to ask? We're going on a retreat. We're going on a retreat. Daniel, are you going to be there? Are you going on this retreat? You know the first thing he's going to say? No, stage two. What are we going to do there? And so I say, oh, we're going down the biggest water slide in Europe. Really? Oh man, we're doing this. I'll be there. I mean, I've never been on the biggest water slide in Europe. I want to do it. I'll do it. And then we should get to September 3. Hey, Daniel, we're going on the biggest water slide in Europe. And you're going to be going, I don't care. Who cares? Who give a rip? You're going to be, who's going to be there? Right? And what's most important is not what we're going to do, but who's going to be there. And not just are they wonderful, amazing people, but are they my people, right? Are they my friends? How will I feel in that group of people when I'm there? Relationships just become, that is the world I live in. I live in the world of relationships. I measure everything. And then relationships, I think a lot about what you think about me. My sense of identity depends on my relationships. I choose my friends based on who I feel accepted by and similar to. And friendships are just huge at this age. Everything revolves around that. And so you can have the most incredible program in the world at your youth group, but if the young person doesn't feel accepted and loved in that place, they're gone. Because their whole world is revolving around these relationships. So, and this is even interesting, Tim, when you go into the schools, because you're going in to perform, but you need to actually establish a relationship as quickly as possible with those people, because you're a rock star, which that'll be okay, that'll help. That's impressive, but if you're a rock star that actually learned my name or saw me or had a conversation or we experienced something together, then all of a sudden you become a totally different kind of authority in my life. Okay, let's move on to stage four. So any things that you recognize as you thought about yourself in stage three? Were you relational? Everything was relationships. Everything was relationships. And what's interesting is even though you were in conflict with your parents, you still really cared about that relationship, which is why when that study was done in Slovakia, the thing they wanted to most improve was their relationship with their parents. Relationships are important, even relationships in tension. It's just the world is about relationships. Now you hit stage four. So actually probably most of you are in stage four. So now we're talking about stage that most of you are in. Now let me just ask a question, Daniel. When you thought about coming to ELF, did you think about all my friends are going to be there? But we are. I mean, I'm a friend of yours. Come on. So what was your question about coming to ELF? Why?
What can I learn?
What can you learn? Okay, it's a really different question. What can you learn? But you know, it's really, we're just going to kind of all hang around and it's just going to be such a good time, and you're going to become a part of this group. And really, that's the value. I mean, that's the value of life, isn't it, Daniel? Okay, now, if I would have met Daniel at 17 years old, he would have given me different answers. The same person is different later on. And so now we've got this, now he's living in the world of concepts and ideas. Now, it doesn't mean he doesn't have relationships, but his reference point is a reference point of concepts and ideas. Actually, for the first time, he can step out of his relationships and go, he could even say, Dave, I'm good friends with you and I disagree with you. And that'd be okay. Or he can say, I think I'm going to be friends with Doreen because we have real similar views. But you would start with the view and then choose the friendship. Otherwise, he'd say, me and Doreen agree because we're friends. See, he would start with the relationship and then come to the opinion. But here now, I actually step out of relationships and live in the world of concepts and ideas. Doesn't mean I don't have relationships, but I can disagree with people that I'm close to. I kind of choose my relationships based on, and I can actually be in a place and be okay there even if I don't have friends, if I'm learning something really good, and if the things I learn fit with the things I want to learn. Do you see how it starts getting into kind of a system? Now, it can get really boxy here. You like, your age, you like systems. This is great because I've given you a wonderful graph that separates out everything. And stage four people love boxes. They're trying to put all their world in the boxes, and they like them when they're clear boxes. One of the things that happens with stage four people is they can get to real black and white. Everything's either or, black and white. You know, good, bad. Because you're just trying to make sense of your world. And this systematic, deliberate, careful, and logical about their belief system likes to fit things together cleanly. So when I go to speak for a student movement in the Czech Republic, what they'll always do is, well, here's one of the things down that my source of authority, they'll always try to bill me as an authority on something. So, and as I come in, when I come into the group, I know that they're sitting there thinking, am I going to get something out of this talk? They're not just thinking, is Dave going to be my friend, right? They're thinking, am I going to get something out of this talk? And they're going to want something that's kind of logical and organized, and they're going to want to interact with it, and they'll want to come out of that meeting with, I just sorted the world out for them a little bit, and so I'm going to say, hey, creation, evolution, which one is right? Oh yeah, which one is right? And I'm going to show up at that meeting. You know, stage three, they might go, I don't know, what do all the rest of you think? All my friends think creation's great. I'm creation. I'm there. So this stage, you know, I can remember my son hit, my oldest son hit stage three. All of a sudden he said one day, Dad, can we all go out for coffee? I was like, right, we got coffee at home. No, I want to go out for coffee. Why? Because we can talk. I said, what do you want to talk about? I don't know. I just want to talk. And he just loved it. This is talk. Now, before that, he wanted to do. Then he wanted to talk. And then he got to stage four, and I said, why don't we do some, let's study the Bible together. What are you interested in? And he says, I'm interested in apologetics and systematic theology. It's cool. Really? we're hitting a different, really different stage. Before, he just wants to talk. And now I want to sort it all out, get my systematic theology. Law and order. The moral reasoning really is what's right, what's wrong. I had a kind of hilarious conversation with my middle son just a little while ago. My middle son's married, and they're trying to have kids. And he says, Dad, we aren't using birth control. In fact, we're morally against birth control. I said, oh, really? Really, why? Yeah, he says, I think it's just wrong when people try to take their future into their own hands. They're not trusting God when they use birth control because they're trying to control their entire lives. And so we aren't going to use birth control. And I'm going, okay, it's fine if you don't use birth control. But he's making this moral law, you know. And this is often what happens at this time. It's because of this moral law, this big thing that I'm not going. No, it's because you guys don't want to, and you want to have kids. I mean, whatever. But it can be pretty funny at this. People get real boxy at this age. So I said, I love you, and I hope you have kids soon, and all that. I choose my beliefs, and then my friends, based on those beliefs, I'm able to separate. A source of authority, my judgment. So my judgment is source of authority. People are information compatible with my basic beliefs. So, you know, is he from my stream of theology? Is he from my basic background? Someone who's competent, well-informed. Oh, he has a doctorate. Wow, this person wrote this book. Oh, I'm going to listen to them. So it's much more like that. If you go to your high school students, this person wrote a book, they're going to go, so? pop stars are huge sources of authority. But they're a lot because of that relational thing, because people start to live vicariously through them. You know, I want to be like them. That's my model or something like that. So they really live in this world of concepts and ideas. Here's an interesting piece, and then I want to tie something together. A person will always interpret information from the perspective of the stage they're in. They always will. Always will. And so they're embedded in it. They don't even know they can't get out of it. There's nothing more or less spiritual about one of the stages. It's possible to walk closer to God in any stage. So it's not that stage four is more spiritual, though the nature of the relationship changes. The higher the stages are, however, more developmental and mature. Generally, people have the least tolerance for the stage they just left. And so here's something that happens is, this is something that we have to watch as youth leaders, is if you're in stage four, especially after a little while, you could become intolerant of stage three. And this is most, and the jump stages have an easier time. Generally, stage four parents do better with stage two kids. When they do stage three, stage four parents do not do well with stage three kids. They just miss them. Because stage four and stage two, if you're event oriented, I'm concept and ideas oriented, okay, we can kind of handle that mix. Actually, five and three work too. But the stage that's closest to you is the hardest one for you. And so we have to actually work at that as stage four youth leaders, that we're not running a stage four group, that we're actually running a stage three group, that we translate. Stage transitions, let me go back, create a great deal of disruption, instability in a person. They'll often lose orientation or swing to extremes when they're losing, going from one stage. So it's, the transitions are really difficult. And that's where the transition from two to three is very disruptive. Transition from three to four is very disruptive. You'll often find people losing their faith in those transitions. Because I go to college, and I had this great, wonderful group that I loved, and I go to college, and I've got this professor who's an expert in his field, and he's given me this incredibly logical argument, and God's not a part of it. And he's a real authority. And then, you know, and then I start going like this, and then why do I believe? I believe because all my friends believe. But I really don't care about that anymore. You know, actually, I've got friends with different beliefs, and I don't have a problem with. And then they just lose their faith because they don't have a state. They don't have categories for stage four faith. The engines that move a person forward are stimulation and a rich environment with much to interact with and disequilibration. There's more we could talk about with this. That's really. And then here's some just practical application. Different books of the Bible. You know, these are kind of interesting. What do I tell my parents when I get home from the retreat? And then we, and after that we, and then about got hurt, and you should have seen. That's what I tell my parents. And by the way, if you're running a stage three group, the parents know everything that's going on. As soon as it goes to stage two groups, the parents know everything's going on. Stage three, they won't talk at home about it, or else they won't talk about what went on. They'll say, who fell in love with who fought with who, what we talked about, and how I felt around the people. And you won't, what did you do? I won't know anything about what you did. What they tell, what the speaker said, how the event was organized, what could have gone better, what they should have done, and what it made me think about. So those are the things they'll say. What motivates me spiritually, you'll see. It's the kind of teaching I like the best. How do you become an influential person in my life? Things I don't understand. What activities I enjoy most. So this is just this really helps you if you're knowing what kind of group you are. Books of the Bible that work really well.